Parents today are bombarded with messages about how to raise children. Do this, don't do that. Hover, don't hover. Some parents want a roadmap for something our parents say they did just by instinct. They want to know how to give their children these days an edge, especially. Marketing companies are all too ready to provide the latest video to make your kids smarter in three easy payments of $29.95. Take a deep breath and relax. Really. Say authors Sandra Amott and Sam Wang. She is a former editor-in-chief of Nature Neuroscience, and he is an associate professor of molecular biology and neuroscience at Princeton University. And together, Sandra Amott and Sam Wang have written a book about how a child's brain develops and grows. These are parenting tips from neuroscience. It's called Welcome to Your Child's Brain, How the Mind Grows from Utero to Uni. And Sandra Amott is on the line with us from California. Hello, Sandra.
Hello.
Well, so much has been written about parenting, our eyes glaze over. How much research did you wade through for this book, can I ask?
We read somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,000 scientific papers, Sam and I together.
Right, which would have taken you years, obviously.
We spent a couple of years working on the book, yes.
What gave you the idea for it? Why did you decide to do it?
It's just such an interesting topic. Not only parents trying to figure out how to raise their own children, but all of us, even if we don't have children, once were children and are curious about the processes that led us to become ourselves.
Indeed. Well, as parents, we like to think that when babies are born, that if we can get it just right, if we can feed them the right things, if we can discipline them properly, stimulate their brains the right way, they'll grow up somehow magically gifted little Einsteins, we hope for. But you say that babies' brains can develop and they can grow, sometimes in spite of what parents do.
There's this funny idea that's going around in a lot of cultures right now that children are fragile flowers, that any parental misstep might spell doom for their prospects. But actually, we have spread ourselves all over the world, not by being delicate, but by being resilient and robust to a wide variety of different circumstances. And that's still true today. Children are very tough.
How tough? I guess we can go through it in terms of the way parents regard children. Do most parents worry about the wrong things, Sandra? Can parenting, to what extent can it shape a child's personality, or is the brain going to do what the brain's going to do?
Children aren't blank slates. Every child is born an individual, and your parenting will go much better for everyone if you understand that up front. That said, there are enormous important areas where parents can make a difference to their children's development. For instance, parents can promote the development of self-control, which is one of the best predictors of success in adult life. They can also promote the development of empathy and other social skills, which again are really important for how kids turn out as adults. What they can't do for the most part is have an enormous influence on what kind of a person the child is. That is largely baked in from the beginning. And you can help your child learn how to fit in comfortably with the world, given the personality that that child has. But if you wanted a football player and got a chess player, you really just pretty much have to live with it.
We all hear about Tiger Woods's father, though, don't we? And we assume that that kind of hot housing can produce a golf player. Is that just a happy felicity?
Remember that Tiger Woods' father not only gave Tiger those experiences, but also half of his genes. A lot of times when you see parents behind, ambitious parents behind children, we forget that the children themselves were also ambitious, perhaps for that reason.
Okay, that's putting it neatly. You seem to be saying that boundaries and discipline are still highly important in raising a child, though, to develop that self-control.
Yes, it's very important for children to learn to follow rules and to adhere to sensible restrictions and boundaries. There's two reasons for that. One is that growing up in a chaotic environment is stressful, and stress is bad for kids, at least in large quantities. And the other is that obeying rules and having routines contributes to kids' ability to plan and control their own behavior. And that, as I said before, is very important in adulthood.
You seem to prize something we've begun to hear of in recent years, the learning of languages, the learning of another language reasonably early on in a young person's life.
There are a surprising number of advantages to learning to speak more than one language. Kids who do that from a young age are better at self-control. They are better at learning new rules and adjusting to changes in rules. They're also better at guessing what other people are thinking, so they're better at empathy. And the reason for that presumably is because if you have more than one language, every time you go to talk to somebody, you have to think through, well, what did they know? Do they know this language or that language? How shall I talk to them so that they'll understand? And getting in the habit of doing that builds good emotional skills for interacting with other people.
Sandra, do you have to start doing this from age 3 with a child, or can you do it from age 9? Does it particularly matter when you begin with those developing those extra language skills?
The kids will learn the languages themselves better if they start young, usually before the age of 6. That's what it typically takes to develop full proficiency in a foreign language, to essentially have more than one native language. But it will help at any during any part of childhood. You will get some of the benefits of doing that.
And you say full proficiency. Does a smattering of languages assist? You know, if you learn basic vocabs in German and Greek and French, will that also help or not so much?
It will certainly help less.
All right.
People who speak two languages proficiently for their entire lives have the most benefit, up to, by the way, having a later onset of brain problems in old age.
Yeah, which occupies a lot of our attention at the moment. Welcome to Your Child's Brain, How the Mind Grows from Utero to Uni, and Sandra Armit is with us. How do we know that the flashcards and the Baby Einstein music videos don't work? How do you test a baby's brain, for instance?
The strongest evidence against the baby videos is that children who watch a lot of videos or television or any screen time at all before the age of 2 have significantly decreased number of vocabulary words and poorer language skills at the time that they enter school. And that's because children learn best, well, young children, babies especially, learn best from social interaction. They don't learn very well from passive exposure.
And that continues beyond the age of 2 to a reduced extent, I'm assuming.
Active engagement is always better than passively absorbing something. Don't just listen to music. Learn to play a musical instrument. Don't just watch sports. Get out on the field. That's my number one tip for parents.
And a very good one. You talk about the 5 hidden talents of a baby's brain. What are some of the most important hidden talents that we don't necessarily know about?
It's easy to miss how much babies know because they don't communicate very well. But from an early age, babies are busy sorting out the world. One of the things that they do is almost from birth, at least from 3 months of age, which is about the youngest that we can test this, babies put things into categories and people into groups. So, for instance, if you show a 3-month-old baby a series of pictures of women, eventually they'll get bored and stop paying attention. And then when a picture of a man shows up, all of a sudden they're interested again. And that's because that's a new category of idea that they're being exposed to.
Babies use coincidences too, don't they, to draw conclusions about, they work out cause and effect.
They do. This is something we all do. You've certainly heard of sportsmen who refuse to change their lucky socks because they won the last three times that they played in them. Babies do the same thing. They can learn, for instance, that syllables that they hear together frequently are words, and that syllables that they don't hear together are boundaries between words. If you've ever listened to a foreign language, you know how difficult it is to sort out where one word ends and another one begins. And that's something babies do by determining coincidences in the language that they hear all day.
Okay, so their brains develop in ways that we don't necessarily observe, but they're taking care of their own mental development to a reasonable degree. Are parents there? Why are parents there? To provide the basics, food and shelter. You talk about the importance of guidance in terms of boundaries and discipline, but does it really matter, for example, whether you're a stern parent or a laissez-faire parent? Does it make much of a difference in the end?
The best style for parenting is actually a combination of those two things. The parents who, on the one hand, really are sensitive to their children's needs and understand where their children are coming from, but at the same time don't put up with any nonsense and have expectations that children are going to do well, behave well, achieve. If you only do the one or the other, you're liable to run into difficulty. If you only try to respond to your kids' needs and make them happy all the time, paradoxically, your children will probably be less happy because their lives will be more chaotic and less predictable. And kids, especially little kids, don't like that. And if you are merely stern and don't take any account of what kind of an individual your child is, then odds are that you'll end up insisting on the wrong things that don't help your child.
I understand, and that fits in with our idea of ideal parenting. Given that most of us aren't ideal parents and tend in this modern era to beat ourselves up quite a lot, though, Sandra, we can relax a bit. Our children will turn out pretty well, apart from abusing them, obviously, and neglecting them. Our children would turn out pretty well regardless?
Yes, there are a wide variety of paths that a healthy child can take to reach a happy adulthood. The occasional misstep, the occasional moment of less than ideal parenting, most kids will shrug off. You don't need to worry about those at all, unless there's some kind of systematic pattern of difficulty with your relationship with your child.
Okay, so we can't make our children into great golfers. We can't give them 10 extra IQ points. A lot of parents try and improve deficiencies that they spot, for example, like shyness in a child. To what extent will it work, going to work on a trait like shyness?
What happens with genes in personality traits is that they set a range of possibilities for a child. So if you have a child who's shy, you probably are not going to turn out a great salesman or politician or someone who dances on the tables in bars. Not that most parents aspire to that last one. But what you can do is help to draw a shy child out gently, give them opportunities to interact in small groups where they don't feel overwhelmed, but to talk to other children and learn social skills so that they don't fall behind the other kids in their ability to function in a group, because there are a lot of places in adulthood where that ability comes in handy. It's interesting, though, in different cultures. So New Zealand shares with the United States the idea that it's important for people to be outgoing and sociable. On the other hand, in places like rural China and India, the social ideal is a reserved, quiet person who does not put himself forward. And children who are raised in those cultures, unsurprisingly, turn out more likely to be shy as adults.
But without the consequent loss of self-esteem that can attend that in the West, would that be true?
Exactly, yes. Shyness leads to social success in places like that.
The deleterious effects of stress on a child, stress in the home environment. How much stress? Because there is stress, of course, in every household. You can't avoid it, and there are arguments between parents. When does that start to really, truly impinge on a child's development and mental well-being, can I ask, Sandra?
So stress is not necessarily bad. A small amount of stress or even a moderate amount of stress can help a child to build resilience, the ability to deal with stress. Children who are completely protected and never have anything allowed to go wrong with them often grow up a little more delicate than kids whose lives were a bit less protected. But at some point when stress is chronic, there is a state that you get into where you're hurting your child's development. So I would say that, you know, an occasional parental fight is normal and possibly even helpful, especially if you can model for your child how two people who love each other get back together and make up once they've had a problem. And the other is to not worry so much about it. But if you have a chronic issue where there's screaming in your house every day, that's probably doing some harm and you probably should take some steps to deal with it.
There are other practical tips in the book about things you can do to help your child, and some most of us know, and, you know, people will recognise some of what you've said as common sense. And they include establishing a regular bedtime routine, for instance. One I found interesting, children who spend more time outside are less likely to be short-sighted, Sandra.
This is an interesting example of how genes that have been perfectly fine for most of our evolution have come into conflict with the changing modern world to produce a bad effect. Nearsightedness or short-sightedness has ranged from 2 or 3% of the population in older surveys from the 1960s to as much as 90 or 95% of the population among teenagers in modern Singapore. And the difference that seems to be important is that to grow properly, children's eyes need bright sunlight for something like 2 hours a day. Children who don't get that are much more likely to become short-sighted than children who do.
It's fascinating, and I think you reveal that the rate of near-sightedness in Singapore, for instance, in a more apartment-dwelling life, nearly 9 times higher than in Sydney.
Yes, among people of the same ethnic background. So people, families who moved from Singapore to Sydney decreased their children's rate of short-sightedness enormously just by that one change, which is probably related to the outdoor culture in Australia compared to Singapore.
Yeah, that's a fascinating finding. One of the age-old questions parents have is, how do I get my children to eat spinach and broccoli? Now, you have a recommendation for that, too.
We have several. The simplest one is just to mix those foods with something the child likes. That works, by the way, not only in 2-year-olds, but even in college students. So you can mix them with milk or cream, or even put in a little sugar and then slowly reduce the amounts as the child gets used to it. It's a matter of promoting familiarity and linking that taste to something positive that the child likes.
With the very younger children, though, you've got a 9-second rule, which is intriguing. Can you explain that?
9 seconds is how close together the two tastes have to be in order for this paired taste learning to occur. Since most parents are not going to be sitting around with a stopwatch feeding their child, the simplest way to implement that recommendation is just to mix the foods together. And luckily for most of us, 6-month-olds have no idea that there's anything abnormal about having ice cream and spinach together.
Welcome to Your Child's Brain, How the Mind Grows from Utero to Uni. And Sandra Amott is with us. We've talked about self-control and self-esteem recently on this program, and you've alluded to it already. You call it the greatest gift a parent can give a child. What does the science tell us, please, about, can you flesh it out for us, how important self-control is to the future success of the young person?
A child's self-control at the age of four is twice as predictive of academic achievement in high school than a child's IQ at that same age. And parents can do an enormous amount to promote the development of self-control. One of the least known and also most fun approaches is to get the child involved in doing some multi-step game or project that has rules. Anything from a board game to having a tea party with your dolls to learning a martial art, anything that requires a child to concentrate and stick with one activity for a period of time will be building self-control.
So team sport would come into that category too?
Yes, almost certainly.
Now, telling children how smart they are does not give your child any clue about what to do next time and can even reduce perseverance. What do you praise children for then if you shouldn't be going around saying all the time, oh, you're so clever?
You should be praising them quite simply for whatever you'd like them to do again next time. So instead of saying, wow, you're really smart, you say, wow, you really worked hard on that homework. I'm so impressed with how you stuck with it even after you were having difficulty and finished it anyway. The problem is if you tell children that they're clever, they start to feel like that's an inborn trait that they have no influence over. And in a lot of circumstances, they'll actually get nervous about the possibility of being unmasked as someone who perhaps was not as clever as they initially appeared. Kids who are told that they're smart all the time show less perseverance in difficult tasks, apparently because they get anxious when something is difficult for them. Oh, this might mean I'm not so smart after all. Whereas kids who are taught that intellectual abilities can be improved by hard work and perseverance tend to welcome difficult tasks as an opportunity to improve their skills and work much harder.
One thing I've got to ask you, on behalf of the parents listening who say, you know, gee, this is advice I wish I'd taken a couple of years ago, but my children are 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 now. If I try and apply some of Sandra's rules, are they going to work? Will it work later? Are young people sufficiently malleable even into their teenage years that you can optimize the outcomes for them?
One of the best known experiments showing that children who are taught that intelligence is modifiable do better than children who believe it to be a fixed characteristic was done in 12-year-olds. 12 or 13-year-olds. So that clearly still works even among relatively old children.
That's reassuring to hear. I just want to talk about the subject of weight briefly too, because it's so much on our minds and in our media. Criticizing body shape and weight counterproductive, Sandra?
Absolutely. Especially for young teenage girls, studies show that one of the best predictors of both weight gain and eating disorders, two outcomes that most parents would like to avoid, is being teased about your weight by family members. On the other hand, parents who provide nutritious meals and family dinners, routine opportunities to eat in a comfortable social environment with other family members, are the ones who end up raising children with the least risk of being overweight.
It's a fascinating book, and as we said right at the start, so much science behind it. Thank you very much for talking to us about it, Sandra, and good luck with the book too.
Thank you so much. It was great being here.
Sandra Ammett, and welcome to Your Child's Brain, How the Mind Grows from Utero to Uni.